It can be 6 or 7 million some days and 45 million the next.
How the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is addressing the constant threat of cyber attacks. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 14th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, in the wee hours of the morning, Yor Olsom won the 2018 Iditarod.
It was a slow trail, a soft trail, we had wind, and it was just every leg was more challenging than the other leg.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The Trans-Alaska Pipeline has dealt with its share of problems. Earthquakes, declining oil flow, even gunfire. Today, the pipeline is facing another more modern threat, cyber attacks. Energy infrastructure is a tempting target for hackers, and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is no exception. Alyeska, the company that operates the pipeline, now ranks cyber attacks as one of its top three risks. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
I'm getting escorted into a secure room at Alyeska Pipeline Service Company's Anchorage headquarters, and I notice the symbol of a certain caped crusader taped to the door.
It's the Bat Cave.
My guides don't know why the sign is there. Maybe it's the lack of windows, or maybe it's because the people who work in this room see themselves as undercover crime fighters like Batman, because they kind of are. This is where Alyeska's cybersecurity team works.
So these three monitors are just a few of the things that the cybersecurity engineers are watching every day.
Alyeska's Bill Rossetti is pointing at a wall of data flowing down three giant screens hanging above the cubicles. It's all totally incomprehensible to me. But for Rossetti and his staff, weird activity on one of the colorful charts rippling across the screens could indicate something serious.
The idea here is that we are looking for things to be normal, and anything that's not normal is something that needs to be investigated.
Rossetti is Alyeska's chief information officer. It's his job to keep cyber attackers at bay. Rossetti takes that job seriously because the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is getting hit by cyber attacks all the time, and not just a few.
We see about 22 million attacks a day.
Let's say that again. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline is hit with an average of 22 million cyber attacks every single day. And that's an average.
It can be 6 or 7 million some days and 45 million the next. So I wish I could tell you why that changes that way, but I really don't know.
Of course, there aren't millions of people carrying out these attacks individually. These are mass automated attacks, often coming from servers overseas. Rossetti says so far, none of the cyber attacks have been successful. Alyeska has never been breached. But the challenge is growing. Rossetti says the rate of cyber attacks has roughly doubled in the last 5 years. So how are hackers going after the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and why? Rossetti says they have all kinds of goals and all kinds of techniques. There's phishing, the kind spelled with a PH.
Some are very focused. That's called spear phishing, where they're aimed at our CFO, trying to get people to wire them money.
And then there's attacks that threaten the Trans-Alaska Pipeline itself. As the energy industry settles into the internet age, more of its machinery is controlled remotely by computers. If someone manages to breach those systems, there could be dangerous, real-world consequences. I asked Rossetti what the worst-case scenario would be if there was a major cyber attack on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Well, so I don't actually want to share what the worst case would be because we think about what the worst case is so we can protect against the worst case. And I don't want to share what that is.
Throughout our interview, Rossetti is very vague and careful with his words. He doesn't want to give hackers any clues. But he does acknowledge that a successful cyber attack could interrupt the flow of oil down the pipeline. It could even result in people getting hurt. The growing cyber threat to pipelines and other infrastructure is worrying the topmost levels of government. Late last year, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI issued a warning that sophisticated cyber attackers have targeted the U.S. energy sector in particular. Jim Gwynn is a cybersecurity expert who helps energy companies prepare for cyber attacks. As far as he's concerned, the potential consequences of a major cyber attack should be the number one thing keeping energy executives up at night, if it isn't already.
It could be anywhere from a spill to loss of the command of the plant itself to explosion to loss of life. It would be no different than losing a platform in the Gulf of Mexico or in the North Sea.
Gwynn says the threat level to America's energy system hinges on two factors: the bad guy's capability to pull off a cyber attack and the bad guy's desire to actually inflict damage. So far, those two factors haven't lined up.
There are those in the intelligence community that have openly said that they believe that an attack at scale could occur on U.S. soil or against a U.S. company within the next 12 to 24 months.
Gwynn couldn't speak specifically to the cyber threat facing the Trans-Alaska pipeline, but he says one thing's for sure: the risk isn't going away. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
For the first time in 7 years, someone without the last name CV has won the Iditarod. 31-year-old Norwegian musher Jor Lisem Olsom reached Nome at 3 this morning with 8 dogs. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, Olsom was part of an ultra-competitive 3-way race along a trail many say was exceptionally brutal this year.
Even in the wee hours of a cold night, the raucous, dense crowd stretched for blocks down Front Street to greet Olsom. It was the first time since John Baker's 2011 victory that someone other than Mitch or Dallas Seavey appeared triumphantly in the race chute, and the only foreign-born champion since 2005, when fellow Norwegian Robert Sorley won the race. Olsom took the lead Monday morning, when a ground storm between Shaq Tulik and Koyuk caused frontrunner Nicholas Petit to veer off the trail, opening a window for Olsom to pass on the way up the notoriously fickle Bering Sea coast. The move gave Olsom a time advantage of just a few hours, but he was able to maintain that for the remainder of the race, even as Petit vied to overtake him.
When I left Koyuk, he was sleeping or pretending to be sleeping, so I had no idea he was coming out right behind me there.
This year's trail was harsh, and at times it seemed like bad weather was following the front of the pack, dropping snow and wind to constantly impede their progress. Olsom says even when harsh conditions would relent in one area, new ones would emerge along the next stretch.
It was a slow trail, a soft trail, we had wind, and it was just every leg was more challenging than the other leg.
Olsom's rise to Iditarod champion has been swift ever since his rookie run in 2013, never placing lower than 7th in the world's premier sled dog race. His victory brings $50,000 and a new truck, on top of other prizes he won along the way. This year's race for first was tight. Petit made a critical error that ultimately cost him the race. He arrived in Nome just over 2 hours behind Olsom, with a bigger, faster team. But he says in the stretch heading toward Koyuk, he grew hopelessly lost in whiteout conditions.
I looked to the west a little bit, didn't see anything, went east. I got to the place on the GPS that says there's a trail, but I did loops and there's no trail where there's a trail on the GPS. So then I turned him around, G'd him around, potted him around, and went back where the same direction I came from, just still looking for a trail.
Petit gained a critical edge midway through the race when he took his 8-hour rest early along the Yukon after pushing through a long run to Anvik. The move came before his two main rivals learned the Eagle Island checkpoint would be unavailable, forcing many mushers to haul additional supplies on one of the longest, harshest stretches of the trail. One of those rivals was defending champion Mitch Seavey, who says the relatively warm weather and thick snow made an impact on his team's performance.
It's a regular Alaskan trail, Alaskan winter, so yeah, the deep snow was different and completely different than what we trained for, so we had a lot of fun with it. The dogs are exceptionally tough, but some of these guys I don't think have ever seen snow that deep. So it was different, a little harder work, harder pulling.
Fourth into Nome was Ray Reddington Jr., followed by Bethel's Pete Kaiser and ANIAC's Richie Deal. Rookie Jesse Holmes arrived 7th. Mushers will continue arriving into town over the days ahead until the Iditarod banquet on Sunday. On the Iditarod Trail in Nome, Alaska, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, students in Juneau join in a national march for gun control.
Who are we?
Alaska students!
What we want?
We want to live!
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska Anchorage is investing in Alaska by equipping students with the knowledge and tools for academic success. These students will go on to be the doctors, nurses, teachers, engineers, and artists of Alaska who shape the future of the state by bringing new solutions, inventions, and ideas to the table. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More information at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
Juneau High School students took part in today's national walkout calling for action on gun violence. KTOO's Adeline Baxter followed the downtown walk from Juneau Douglas High School to the State Capitol building.
Enough is enough! Enough is enough! Enough is
More than 100 Juneau Douglas High School students walked out of class and marched to the State Capitol building this morning to call on legislators to take action on gun violence in schools. Senior Theo Hauck led the march up to the Capitol building and encouraged students to continue making their voices heard.
Above us right now are our legislators, our governor, our lieutenant governor, the people who will make these final decisions. So let's let them hear us.
Who are we?
Alaska students!
What do we want?
We want to live!
Governor Bill Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott were in the crowd and applauded as students spoke. Many legislators also attended.
Too many lives have been lost because of our country's lack of progress in fighting gun violence.
Sophomore Katie McKenna called for an end to the thoughts and prayers politicians routinely share after school shootings. Teenage survivors of the Parkland, Florida school shooting have called on lawmakers to cut ties with the National Rifle Association and for stricter gun laws. In Juneau, the student organizers said their protest was not meant to advocate any specific political platform, but McKenna did call for teens to take action and register to vote in the November midterm election.
Alaska legislators, we urge you to look at your colleagues around the country who are moving gun legislation forward and follow suit. Weapons of war have no place in our schools. We are watching, and if you don't act for the sake of our safety, you will be voted out by our generation. When leaders act like children and children act like leaders, you know change is coming.
Across town a little over a year ago, police investigated reported threats by a student at Thunder Mountain High School. Dozens of students there walked out today and remained outside for 17 minutes in honor of the 17 people killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. Hillary Rayfield Green, a survivor of the Route 91 Harvest Festival shooting in Las Vegas last October, joined about 50 students at TM and encouraged them to continue their activism for policy change. She said students spoke as well and took photos to pass along to survivors of the Parkland and Las Vegas shootings.
What I saw today was a group of students who had a purpose. They followed through with their intent on that purpose, and then they returned to their responsibilities as students. And I'm just really proud of them for making that a respectful and responsible choice.
Walking back to school from the Capitol, Juno Douglas sophomore Molly Minnick said students feel fear every time they hear about another shooting or take part in an active shooter drill at school.
Today was actually Spirit Week, and it was Future Careers Day. So we're out here representing who we want to be when we're older. And if we're dead tomorrow, we'll never get to do that.
After returning to school grounds, JD students gathered on the turf field for a moment of silence for victims of gun violence. As it ended, Hauck spoke up again.
I don't want to ever have to do that again. And I know you guys don't either, but we probably will. But it's things like this, students like us, that are going to change that. So that there isn't another student killed at school. And we can use this turf to like play soccer and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, soccer, yeah.
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 Thank you all. Go back to class.
All told, students at JD missed about an hour of school, and TM students were outside for about half an hour. The district said beforehand that normal consequences would apply for any unexcused absences during the walkout. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
The state house is considering enshrining permanent fund dividends in the state constitution, but how to do it and whether it would accomplish what its sponsors say it would isn't clear. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the debate over the amendment.
For the part of the state budget the legislature directly controls, Alaska's government currently spends more than twice as much as it receives in revenue. To cover the remaining $2.5 billion gap, the legislature is preparing to draw money from the Alaska Permanent Fund earnings for the first time. Until now, the earnings have only been spent on dividends and a few small programs. Most lawmakers now say that most of the gap must be closed with permanent fund earnings. Homer Republican Representative Paul Seaton says he's concerned that in the future, if there is a deficit, members of the Republican-led Senate majority would eliminate the dividend before approving taxes. Seaton would prefer that taxes close the gap. He sees the proposed amendment as a way of preserving the dividend.
We want to make sure that there's a strong dividend, a stable dividend, into the future generations, and that's why we're taking this action.
Majority caucus senators have said that spending cuts and rising oil revenue should close the gap, but they've also proposed a smaller dividend than the House. Concern over the PFD's future led House members to propose a constitutional amendment. The draft amendment would each year set aside 4.75% of the average value of the permanent fund over the previous 5 years. Two-thirds could be used for the government, one-third would be spent on dividends. That division rankled members of the public who testified on Monday. Joel Sigman at the MATSU Legislative Information Office reflected their frustration.
You need to quit taking from the people. If they can't budget what they already got, they need to live on $8,500 a year like I do and see how long they got their stuff and see if they got a home and stuff when they're done.
Ed Martin of Cooper Landing told legislators the state should sell public land to raise money.
You people don't have the spirit of Alaska in you like the pioneers did. You need to get it back, and I don't know how to shake it to you.
House members originally proposed that the amendment guarantee that a third of the draw, quote, shall, end quote, be devoted to PFDs. On the advice of the nonpartisan legislative legal director, Doug Gardner, the amendment was revised to say the legislature, quote, may, end quote, appropriate up to a third for PFDs. That's because amendments can only change one part of the Constitution. Since the proposed amendment would already change the permanent fund, it couldn't also change how the legislature appropriates money. Gardner told lawmakers they could use the word shall instead of may, but it would likely lose a court challenge.
You've known me for a while, and I'm a balls and strikes kind of person, and I would say it's very likely that you will lose that case.
Gardner says if the legislature wants to make multiple changes through amendments, it could do that through a constitutional convention. Anchorage Democratic Representative Chris Tuck says the amendment could provide stronger protection to the PFD than the current law.
If it's unconstitutional to put shall language in there, we'll look at that a little bit further. But I would tell you this, may language in the Constitution throws a lot more weight than a shall language in statute. So it's still way better than what we have right now in protecting the permanent fund dividend.
Even if all 22 members of the House majority voted for the amendment, 5 minority Republicans would also have to approve it. That may be a challenge. North Pole Republican Representative Tammy Wilson says she would like to have a constitutional guarantee that the amount available for PFDs is 50% of the amount being drawn from the fund. Wilson is willing to wait for a constitutional convention to say that the dividend shall be one half of the draw.
Well, I think if there was any time for a constitutional convention, this would be it. This is something important to pretty much every Alaskan.
If the House does pass the amendment this year, the Senate would also have to approve it. Another concern that lawmakers are struggling with was raised by Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation CEO Angela Rodell. She says the corporation board wouldn't support the amendment due to another provision that's currently included in the proposal. That provision would allow the legislature to spend more than 4.75% of the fund's value if 3/4 of both chambers agree to it. Rodell says that would make draws from the fund unpredictable. She says this would make it difficult for fund managers to make investment decisions.
So it's going to provide a level of instability that we're looking to avoid with a constitutional amendment. It introduces that instability in perpetuity.
Seaton says he would like to advance the amendment to the House floor this week. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
The search for two climbers missing on the Juneau ice field has ended. Alaska State Troopers say 34-year-old George Ryan Johnson of Juneau and 25-year-old Marc-André Leclerc of British Columbia are presumed dead. Their families have been notified. Sergei Leclerc wrote on Facebook Tuesday evening, "Sadly, we have lost two really great climbers, and I lost a son I'm very proud of." During a break in the weather earlier Tuesday, a Coastal Helicopters aircraft with members of Juneau Mountain Rescue on board flew out to the north face of the Mendenhall Towers. Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters says an intact anchor rope was spotted on the top of an ice chute on the fourth tower. Searchers also found other climbing ropes in a crevasse midway down the tower.
And they were able to see some climbing ropes that matched the description of what the climbers used.
Peter says they don't plan on a recovery operation because of the avalanche danger and other safety hazards. She says new files were created in a missing persons database in the event the climbers' remains are discovered later. Peter says searchers were able to hone in on the pair's location after getting a signal back from a RECO reflector. Different from avalanche beacons, RECO reflectors are sometimes built inside helmets, boots, or outdoor clothing, and even when covered by snow, can reflect a signal. The Trump administration has awarded a major grant to a small community on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
The Tuksuk Bay tribe has received more than $10 million to construct trails to the nearby community of Nightmute and along the coast to the fishing grounds at Umkamute, an important subsistence location.
They catch all kinds of fish like salmon, halibut.
Tuksuk Bay Tribal Transportation Manager Harry Tulik had just returned from muskox hunting when he got the news last week.
We were so overwhelmed and happy and so proud with our community.
Besides facilitating access to subsistence, the trails will connect residents of Nightmute to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Subregional Health Clinic in Tuksuk Bay. The funding comes from a $500 million grant program to improve transportation projects throughout the country. It goes by the acronym TIGER, Transportation Investment Generating Economic Recovery. This year, more than half that funding went to rural areas and to only one project in Alaska. In Tuksuk Bay, the money will pay for 21 miles of synthetic geocell mats laid across the tundra. Right now, those trails are what's been carved by four-wheelers and snow machines. Tulik calls them a big mess. The trails become too slushy or muddy to pass, causing drivers to take wider and wider paths that tear up the tundra. The mats will stabilize the trails while providing temporary local jobs. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
7 years ago this week, a magnitude 9.1 earthquake struck off the coast of Japan, triggering a tsunami with waves up to 30 feet high. The event ravaged communities, and its after effects have been felt across the Pacific. Now, scientists estimate that following the tsunami, more than 10 times as much debris washed ashore in North America than what was measured before. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more.
People don't enjoy seeing garbage in their outdoor spaces. Dr. Catherine Murray says that's especially true in places like Alaska that can end up with other countries' trash.
Places like Alaska, you're getting debris from places far away, so there's not much you can do about it on a local scale. So you can't say to your own community, let's stop using plastic bags and then we'll stop seeing garbage on the beach. And in those cases, it's not often true because it's coming from very far away.
Following the Great Japan Tsunami in 2011, researchers noted that there seemed to be more marine debris than usual. Over 4 years of monitoring, the team recorded that nearly 100,000 items washed ashore from Alaska to Oregon. In Washington and Oregon, it was easier to respond to reports of debris, but it was a challenge to figure out how much debris there was in more remote and pristine places like Alaska or British Columbia. Aesthetics isn't the only reason to be worried about the debris. It can impact wildlife and human health. And now Murray says they think sea creatures from Japan have managed to cross the ocean with the trash.
Because they had rafted such a long way away and they took a very slow journey across the ocean, a lot of the species ended up in quite good condition. Some of them were reproductive when they landed. Some of them were growing at sea.
Species have always had the ability to raft, but it was on natural items like wood or pumice stones.
But now we enter plastic into it, which doesn't degrade indefinitely. So it is floating around and can allow species to make these long, long journeys, whereas before, their raft would have broken down into pieces and left them in the middle of the ocean.
Increasing storm intensity may mean natural disasters like tsunamis will be bigger and have greater impacts. Murray is worried that will mean more plastic and maybe even more hitchhikers will be able to cross oceans. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Adeline Baxter, Matt Miller, and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night!
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com.
And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating more than 40 years of Alaska operations. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.